by transcription.
Apprehension seems to exist among the people that by the accession of a Republican administration, their property and their peace and personal security are to be endangered.
Mr. President, starring Edward Arnold and written by Gene Holloway. Mr. President at home in the White House, the elected leader of our people, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little-known stories of the men who've lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. True human stories of Mr. President.
In just a moment, we'll bring you Edward Arnold as the man in the White House. Many years ago, the president sat in a ladder-back, cane-bottomed chair and read reports written by young men whose wages he paid out of his own pocket. No telephones plagued him. He could come and go as he pleased. Today, the president sits in an air-conditioned office, surrounded by telephones. If he wants to walk, he must stay inside the White House grounds. From the ladder-back chair to air conditioning, from then to now, many presidents have lived in the White House. Men of differing personalities, tempers, and talents. Our Mr. President's job is to play them all, and he's done it. Edward Arnold has become the man in the White House. On the street and in stores, he's greeted with, "Hello, Mr. President, we like the show, and we know you'll like it too." So listen now and see if you can name the president upon whom this episode is based.
Many of our listeners have written me telling of their interest in one president's story or another. We received so many of these letters that we thought it might be a good thing to ask our listeners to select the four greatest Mr. President stories. They can be stories that we have done on our program or new stories yet to be scheduled. Your favorite story may be the feud between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, or maybe the story of the attempted impeachment of Andrew Johnson or Teddy Roosevelt and the Panama Canal. We would like to hear from all of you on your favorite story of a president. Let me have your letters as quickly as possible. Once the letters start pouring in, we will be able to pick the four stories our listeners feel are the greatest. Send your letter to me, Mr. President Edward Arnold, the American Broadcasting Company, New York, New York. I hope to be able to schedule the first in this new series early in February. And now, for today's Mr. President story that happened in Washington a few years ago. Listen closely and see if you can tell who the president was. The president-elect was alone in his hotel room talking to General Scott.
Sir, I want you to know that we've taken every possible precaution for your inauguration.
General, I feel very sad. The precautions are necessary. I don't like the feeling that I'm being escorted into the office with armed men on all sides of me.
I appreciate your feelings, but what must be done must be done.
From the hour of my election, the threat of death has been constantly around me. And the people around me have constantly forced me to play what I consider a coward's role. I don't want guns between my people and me. I want to stand before them, fearless in the sunlight. And if they would rather kill me than listen to me, let them do it.
It's better to live and accomplish your purpose in life, even though you give them a chance to use the word coward, than it is to die and accomplish nothing.
You're right. There's no question about that.
Well, now, here are the plans of the day. Senator Baker of Oregon and Senator Pierce of Maryland will ride with you and the retiring president in a drive from Willard's Hotel to the Capitol.
Fine.
Your carriage will be surrounded by marshals. There will be enough of them so that it will be impossible for anyone to reach the presidential carriage with a shot. The drive will be made between double files of cavalry.
You're certainly taking no chances. I can see that, General.
Troops of cavalry will be stationed at every intersection along Pennsylvania Avenue, and riflemen will be on the roofs of buildings all along the route to watch the crowds. I myself will be with an artillery battery to the north of the Capitol building, and there will be 60 armed guards stationed under the portico where you are to speak.
Well, I'm certainly making a military entrance into history. Wouldn't you say that, General?
I'm afraid that your term in office will be a military term, sir.
You mean you believe there will be a war?
I do.
I hope and pray you're wrong, General. I hope and pray you're wrong. Come in.
Good day, General Scott. How nice to see you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Where have you been, my dear?
Oh, the boys and I have been for a walk around the Capitol building. My goodness, everything's in a mess.
A mess?
Well, they're building the dome on the Capitol building, you know.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. I couldn't imagine what you were referring to. Where are the boys?
I sent them to clean up.
General Scott has just been going over the plans for the inauguration with me.
Oh? Well, we haven't long to wait now, have we, General Scott?
No, not long. Well, if you'll excuse me, sir, I have a great deal to do.
Yes, of course, of course. It was nice of you to stop by, and thank you, sir.
I'll be in touch with you later in the day. Good day.
Good day.
Good day. Oh, my goodness, I'm tired. I have a fitting this afternoon, too, on my gown for the inaugural ball.
Mm-hmm. Can you believe that we're really here in Washington?
Well, of course. My dear, I've always known that you'd be president of the United States someday.
Is that why you married me?
Undoubtedly.
Oh, why, shame on you.
Well, that's what you get for asking a question like that. But actually, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you weren't elected president because other people saw the same things to love and admire in you that I saw.
Madam President, that's a very lovely compliment.
I meant every word of it.
Tell me, you've been out, had a chance to talk to people and listen. What are the people speaking of? What do they talk about?
They speak of war.
War? Well, what is to be will be.
Don't think of that now. Think of tomorrow. Tomorrow you'll be the President of the United States.
Yes. Tomorrow I will be the President of the United States.
Fellow citizens of the United States, in compliance with a custom as old as the government itself, I appear before you to address you briefly and to take in your presence the oath prescribed by the Constitution of the United States, to be taken by the President before he enters on the execution of his office. I do not consider it necessary at present for me to discuss those matters of administration about which there is no special anxiety or excitement. Apprehension seems to exist among the people of the southern states that by the accession of a Republican administration, their property, their peace, and personal security are to be endangered. There has never been any reasonable cause for such apprehension.
Mr. President, as is customary for the retiring president, I now turn over this house, the executive mansion, to you and your family.
Thank you.
You are as happy, my dear sir, on entering this house as I am in leaving it and returning home. You are the happiest man in this country.
I hope that you are happy, sir, and that I will be.
My niece has ordered dinner prepared for you. The house is your home from this moment. Goodbye, Mr. President. God keep you.
I'm here in the office, son.
Oh, this room.
Ooh, what's the matter with this room?
Nothing, but it's not as good as some of the rooms. Willie and I have been all over the house.
Ooh, where is Willie?
He's down the kitchen talking to the cook. He's hungry.
Oh, well, aren't you hungry?
No, I talked to the cook about an hour ago.
Oh, I see, I see.
Whose picture is that behind you?
That's President Andrew Jackson. Where's your mother? I haven't seen her for hours.
Well, she's been exploring the house, too. She's making lists.
Lists?
Lists of things that have to be done. I don't think I like this house.
Why not?
I like home better.
You know, if I could plan for every small boy in America, I would wish that he could live as you will live for a few years of his life in this very house.
Why?
Because some of the greatest men in this country's history walked through that doorway. Sat at this desk, lived within these walls. Because words that have changed all our lives have been spoken in the rooms of this house. the doctrines that we all follow and revere, created and discussed, and from here, given to the people. Because within these walls, the great men of our history have lived and worked and prayed, have laughed at times and wept at times. And when they left the house, left something of themselves behind. My boy, this house is sacred. It's a privilege to live here.
Yes, Father.
I'll tell you some more stories about it as the days pass, but you don't believe some of the exciting things that happened here.
Mr. President.
Oh, in here, in the study, my dear.
Well, dinner will be ready shortly, dear. Mm-hmm. I have all your things laid out for the ball. The Grand March will be at 11 o'clock. You're to lead it with Mayor Barrett, and I'm to follow you on the arm of Senator Douglas. My, it's all so exciting.
I wish I was old enough to go.
When you are old enough to go, you'll wish you weren't.
Why?
Now, don't ask your father to explain that now, son. It'll take him all the rest of the night. And we must get ready for dinner and the ball now. And tomorrow, well, tomorrow we'll really set about getting properly moved in.
Yes, my dear. You move in on the executive mansion, I'll move in on the government. I start my meetings the first thing in the morning.
Goodness, you're back, Mr. President. The committee from Virginia is waiting in the study.
Oh, thank you, my dear. We're a little ahead of time.
They arrived right after you left for the cabinet meeting. I tried to entertain them the best I could, but, oh, I've got so much to do, dear.
I see. But I'll go right in. Good day, gentlemen. Good day. I'm sorry I've kept you waiting so long.
Mr. President, we know you are busy, and we'll come straight to the point. We have come direct from the Virginia Convention. Virginia has voted 60-53 against seceding from the Union, Mr. President.
I'm very happy to hear that.
But we have been asked to get a statement from you on your future policy, Mr. President.
Gentlemen, my policies remain exactly as I stated them in my inaugural address. If you will recall, I said at that time, the power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government.
Is this the message you wish us to take back to the Virginia Convention?
It is the only answer I can give you, gentlemen.
The convention hoped that possibly you had modified your stand in some way, Mr. President.
Gentlemen, I said in my address, and I repeat, in the hands of my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail them. There will be no conflict unless they are the aggressors. They have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. Now, gentlemen, I cannot in any way modify what I have said. I believe it with my whole heart.
President, you know, of course, Fort Sumter has surrendered.
Yes. General Scott, I have just issued a proclamation calling upon the loyal states to help preserve the Union and to furnish 75,000 volunteers to fight if necessary.
May I ask if you expect Virginia to join the secessionists, Mr. President?
I'm afraid, General Scott, that I do.
Does this proclamation mean that you have resigned yourself to war now?
No. Not yet. Not yet. It simply means that I am preparing for war and praying for peace. But I fear that the combination of states we find arrayed against us is far too powerful to be subdued by ordinary process of law.
We are, of course, recruiting all the men we can in Washington. We have one division of 3,500 men ready for service.
That's splendid, General.
They are under Colonel Stone. With your permission, he wishes to send the division to seize 10,000 barrels of flour that are waiting to be shipped from the Georgetown flour mill.
Seize the flour? Seize it?
There is only enough flour in Washington to supply the people with bread for 3 days. We need that flour.
Well, what does Secretary of War Cameron say? Have you spoken to him?
He says take it. There are 60,000 people here that must be fed, Mr. President. The city should be cut off from the rest of the country. We would need that flour desperately.
Well, General, If such measures are necessary, then take it.
Well, Mr. President, if war should develop, it seems like I have to preface everything I say that way.
Never mind, General. We all do.
There was a man appointed colonel of the 1st Cavalry who I think might be our principal commander in the field. To me, this one man alone is worth 50,000 men.
What's his name, General?
Colonel Robert E. Lee.
What on earth are you doing, son?
I'm practicing to be a volunteer fighter. So's Willie.
Where's he?
Willie's practicing in the kitchen, in case he gets hungry while he's drilling.
Willie is such a practical boy.
We've got to be ready to fight, because everyone says you aren't going to get any volunteers.
Who says that?
Oh, people. I've heard lots of people say it.
Don't you believe enough people have faith in this government to fight and defend it?
Do you, Father?
Yes, I do.
But no volunteers have come.
No. No volunteers have come. Not yet. Not yet. Mr. Blair, as my friend and as a friend of Colonel Lee's, I would like you to go to him and ask him if he will assume command of the armies of the United States.
I'll go to him at once, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Mr. President, you must get some sleep.
You know, sometimes I wonder if I'll ever be able to sleep, really sleep again. Do you realize they could bombard Washington from the heights across the Potomac?
You asked for volunteers. Have you had any response yet? Of course, it's early.
Early or not, I've already had a storm of protest saying that my request was unconstitutional and revolutionary, that I was pushing this country into war, that I was... Well, there's no use of going over it all again. I wanted the volunteers as a defense measure only. I've made it clear, I thought, all along, that this government would never be the aggressors. But people don't believe me.
Now, who could that be?
I don't know.
Have you an appointment this late?
No.
Good evening, Madam President.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Blair.
Oh, come in, Mr. Blair. I'm awfully glad to see you. Come in.
I've just come from Colonel Lee.
Sit down, won't you?
Thank you.
I hope you have good news for me. I certainly need some tonight.
I'm afraid not, Mr. President. Colonel Lee says that he cannot draw sword on his native state of Virginia.
I see.
He says that although he does not believe in secession as a constitutional right and does not want to see this country at war, that if Virginia fights, he must fight with her.
I respect his opinion. And I'm deeply disappointed. But...
It was a very difficult decision for Colonel Lee. He's resigning from the United States Army and going home to Virginia.
I see. Well, thank you for coming to me at once with this news, Mr. Blair.
Don't worry, Mr. President. You'll win this fight.
Alone?
You aren't alone, Mr. President. Give the people time. You aren't alone.
In just a moment, we'll come back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
It doesn't take much remembering to remember the 42,000 victims in last year's record-breaking polio epidemic. That's right, the number of victims was 42,000, of whom 60% were children under 10 years old. Thousands of those stricken youngsters are still sick, still under treatment, still in need of help. The help you can lend by giving to the March of Dimes. The National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis cares for everyone who needs it, carries out research, and stands as the greatest single effective block against this dread disease, but it needs your help. It needs it more desperately than ever before. This is your responsibility, a responsibility best met by giving your dimes and your dollars. Give and give again to combat polio. Keep those dimes and dollars rolling in to your local March of Dimes headquarters. And now back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
I
I'm sure you've guessed who the president was when all this happened, because it all did happen in Washington a few years ago. 3 days after the president's proclamation, 532 volunteers from Pennsylvania marched into Washington. And the next day, the Massachusetts regiment marched up Pennsylvania Avenue. But they came single file, carrying 17 wounded and the sad news of many dead. They'd been attacked and stoned in Baltimore.
Mr. President, as mayor of Baltimore, I must inform you that Baltimore considers your proclamation calling for troops an act of war on the South. They do not consider that northern troops have any right to march through Baltimore.
Mr. Mayor, I protest that the movement of those troops is not an act of war. They are coming here for one reason only, and that is to protect this city.
I appreciate your feeling, Mr. President, but it is difficult to control the people of Baltimore. They have their own feelings.
Has Baltimore declared war on the Union?
No, Mr. President.
I am told that a bridge on the Northern Central Railroad has been disabled and that no trains can cross. Is that true?
That is true, but it was done as a peaceful measure, Mr. President, to prevent bloodshed.
And the telegraph wires from Baltimore to Washington. Was this, too, a friendly gesture to prevent bloodshed?
Well, I admit that the telegraph offices are in the hands of the secessionists.
Mr. Mayor, I must get the troops I have requested to Washington. I will ask them to go around the city of Baltimore in the future. They will not march through the city. But I promise this only in return for your promise that they will not be molested. Because if they are again, it's entirely possible that neither you or I would be able to control what might happen in Baltimore.
I will do my best to control the people of the city, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. President, we find ourselves in a very undesirable position.
Yes, General Scott?
This city is like a completely isolated island. The railroad bridges between Washington and the north are out of commission. Track has been torn up. The telegraph wires north are cut. We can't get mail in or out. And our enemies are on our doorstep.
I don't doubt it. And from the reports I've been getting, a goodly supply of federal arms is in the hands of the secessionists. They're on our doorsteps with our own guns.
We may lose the city, Mr. President.
No, General Scott. Help will come from the north. I am confident of that.
I wish I was as confident as you are. Or do you have some knowledge that I don't have, Mr. President?
No knowledge, General. No knowledge. Just faith.
On what do you base this faith?
I believe that right is on our side, General. And I believe that right always triumphs in the end.
It's almost 4 in the morning.
Hmm?
Do you realize that?
Oh, why is it really? I had no idea it was so late.
Oh, I don't know what to do with you. You don't get any rest at all anymore. What's going to happen to the city, Mr. President?
I've been sitting here asking myself the same question, and I wish I knew the answer.
Everyone says that you never seem to worry or to be upset about anything. But I know better.
I don't dare let them see that I'm troubled or have any fear of the outcome. They search my face for hope, and I want them to find it there.
The city is completely shut off.
Yes, it is. Do you know at night you can see the Confederate fires on the south bank of the Potomac?
I know.
I said to someone today that we must prove that popular government is not an absurdity. We must settle this question now. Whether in a free government the minority have the right to break it up whenever they choose. If we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of the people to govern themselves. Taking the government as we found it, we will see if the majority can preserve it.
We'll win somehow. I'm confident of that, Mr. President.
Well, I've been thinking and thinking this whole long night, going over and over what I must do to preserve this union. I'm going to take a lot of things upon myself tomorrow. I'll be criticized for it, but I'm going to do it.
What are you going to do?
First of all, I'm going to have United States Marshals enter the major telegraph offices and seize the records of all messages sent and received. I'm going to send an armed revenue cutter to sea to protect our commercial ships. I'm going to order 5 steamships, purchased or chartered, and armed for public defense. I'm going to order the money taken out of the Treasury for the expenses necessary. In short, my dear,
I'm about to become a wartime president.
Thomas, did you hear that?
Hear what, Mother?
Well, it sounded like a locomotive whistle. Oh, well, it couldn't have been, though, because no trains have been able to get into the city. Listen! Listen, Thomas, listen! Mr. President! Mr. President, come to the door! Come to the door!
I'm coming, my dear, I'm coming.
Look at them! Just look at them.
That's the 7th from New York. And behind them are the 1,200 men from Rhode Island. And the Butler Brigade from Massachusetts.
Oh, they've come. Praise be to God. They've come at last.
Isn't that a splendid sight, Mr. President?
General Scott, how did they get through? How did they manage it?
They came by train from Annapolis. They had their own track layers working to put the road in order ahead of the train. There's 10,000 troops in the city, Mr. President. 10,000 troops.
Yeah, we'll hold the Union now, General Scott. With men like that fighting beside us, we'll save the Union. Yes, we will save the Union. Well, you've probably figured out by now who the president was when all that happened. It really did happen, you know, and you'll have the answer in just a moment.
The adjective dynamic is a pretty good description of Walter Winchell, one of the country's most powerful reporters of the news. Winchell's dynamic news delivery has made him a favorite with millions of people. For Winchell not only tells the facts about the news, he gets behind the news to bring you startling exposés. Winchell is famous, too, for his daring exclusives. And when a news story breaks, whether here in America or in a far-off news center, you can count on Winchell to have a different story about it. A story you won't read about in your papers. So for important inside news on the headline events of the week, hear Walter Winchell when he broadcasts tonight and every Sunday evening over most of these same ABC stations. And now back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Mr. President, I can hardly believe that it's over. Really over.
It is indeed, my dear. Richmond has fallen. Petersburg has been evacuated.
They're waiting for you downstairs, Mr. President.
Thank you. Shall we go, my dear? And will you take my arm?
Thank you. I'll be very proud to take your arm, Mr. Lincoln.
Remember to send me your letters giving me your selection of what you think is the greatest presidential story. Send your letters to Mr. President, American Broadcasting Company, New York, New York. Now be sure to listen next week for another interesting story that happened in Washington a few years ago to Mr. President. Until then, goodbye.
This program is produced and directed by Dick Woolen. Mr. President was created by Robert G. Jennings. Edward Arnold is soon to be seen in the MGM picture, The Yellow Cabman. Today's story was based on incidents in the life of President Abraham Lincoln.
Be sure to listen again next week when the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations bring you Edward Arnold with another interesting and factual story of Mr. President. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.